gender roles in Georgian Britain. It has been argued that the 18th century was a time of transition from an early modern society where gender roles and identities were not fixed to a modern bourgeois society where fixed gender ideologies underpin society and culture. In this lecture, I want to look at this in more detail by considering deviant male and female types, the rise of separate spheres ideology, the feminist challenge, and the importance of the reformation of manners. Women's presence in the military in the 18th century is well documented. And for many contemporaries, these military women were hailed as heroines. But by the 19th century, the changing social climate meant that they were often written out of the historical record or portrayed as freaks of nature. The theme of women dressing as men to gain access to male power and privilege was common throughout European folk literature. They began with the legendary Amazons, the tribe of women who vowed to defend themselves and to forsake marriage when their husbands were killed in battle. However, these stories of female soldiers were also indicative of fluid and evolving concepts of gender. In the 18th century, it was acceptable to believe that gender was a variable, externally determined entity that could be easily and tolerably transgressed. Thus, there was a friendly reception of female soldiers such as Christian Davis, Susanna Cope, Hannah Snell, and Marianne Talbot. They are all generally from the lower echelons of society and thus were transgressing class as well as gender boundaries. But by the 19th century, concepts of gender and class were more firmly entrenched. It was no longer accepted that women could merely change their attire and convincingly become men. Cross-dressing women then became an abomination of nature and a challenge to entrenched sexual stereotypes. Male identities were also fluid in the 18th century. We can see this by looking at the libertines and fops. Libertines have a long history with antecedents in the sodomites of the Renaissance. These men were flamboyant figures and are particularly dominant in the history of masculinity from the 1670s onwards. They're not necessarily homosexuals. The Earl of Rochester, for example, is the exemplary rake, a man who engages in sex with boys or with women. Thus, the libertine is associated with sexual deviancy of all kinds. However, as Randolph Trumbach has charted, by about 1750, effeminacy had become linked to same-sex desire. Over time, the fop merged with other male characters, the Molly and the Queen, for whom effeminacy was a marker of their desire for other men. Trumbach argues that this had considerable significance for gender roles. Thus, the effeminate sodomite became the character against whom heterosexual man was defined. However, Philip Carter has argued that in fact the fop was a social type, quite distinct from the sexual category of Molly. To be a fop did not mean you were understood to be a sodomite. Rather, a fop was a vain, self-obsessed character who failed to live up to the goodwill, ease and integrity of the polite gentleman. So why did things change? One of the main theoretical debates which underpins much of the discussion of gender roles can be encapsulated by the debate about separate spheres. This term has been used to describe the accentuation of gender differences amongst the middle classes, which took place in the 18th and early 19th centuries, stimulated by evangelical revival. Public life was increasingly seen as an exclusively male domain, and domesticity came to be the sphere of activity in which women's moral virtues could most fully be developed. The use of separate spheres to characterise gender relations has been challenged by historians such as Linda Kerber and Amanda Vickery, who've argued that separate spheres in the 19th century were neither new nor restricted to a single social class. Catherine Gleadle has argued that several spheres is a more adequate term to describe the ways in which middle-class women interpreted their public and political identity. The complicated nature of separate spheres discourse can be analysed by looking at the work of Mary Wollstonecraft, often termed the first feminist writer in Britain. Wollstonecraft came from the urban middle classes. Her father fell on hard times, and thus in the 1780s, Mary and her two sisters had to support themselves. The only options open to them were to take up posts of governesses or to set up shops or schools. Eventually, Mary managed to establish herself as a woman of letters among a small group of intellectuals in London. Her first political work was A Vindication of the Rights of Men, which was among the first replies to the conservative Edmund Burke in 1790. Wollstonecraft's response was concerned less with the defence of the revolution and more with a direct attack on Burke himself, whom she attacked for his belittlement of the poor. She contrasted his sorrows for the downfall of Marie Antoinette with the distress of many industrious mothers. In The Vindication of the Rights of Woman, published in 1792, Mary Wollstonecraft drew attention to the corrupting effects of unequal education and expectations on women, and expressed her vision of the possibility of a new political and moral order in which women too were equal citizens. Mary Wollstonecraft subsequently visited France, and as she watched the events of the Terror, came to feel less optimistic about the possibilities of radical political transformation. Whilst she was in France, she had an affair and lived with the American adventurer, Gilbert Imlay, giving birth to their first daughter, Fanny. In her last work, Maria or the Wrongs of Women, a novel which was set in an asylum, she was to explore the oppressive conditions of marriage for the middle-class woman and the situation of poor women through the depiction of the life of the servant in the asylum, Jemima. Maria was never completed and was posthumously published after Mary Wollstonecraft died in childbirth by her husband, William Godwin. Godwin's Memoirs of the Author of the Rights of Women, published in 1798, told the story of her private life and associated her name indelibly with sexual freedom and notoriety. There are several themes throughout Mary Wollstonecraft's writing. First of all, education. In The Vindication of the Rights of Women, Mary Wollstonecraft focuses on education, attacking the views particularly of Rousseau, who had written on the education of girls, suggesting that their interests be subordinated to boys. Wollstonecraft then expressed in The Vindication her idea of dissociation of ideas. She argued that women were conditioned by their upbringing, and that if they were exposed to the same education as men, they would have the rational capacity to become citizens. She argued that women would not always remember that they were women if they were allowed to acquire more understanding. She attacked Rousseau's misogyny while subscribing to his revolutionary political ideal, appealing only for women's inclusion within it. She thought the right kind of education, bringing with it the right association of ideas, could transform the female character. And she planned a new system of national education in which all, rich and poor, girls and boys would be educated together until the age of 9. A second theme is the theme of rights. Mary Wollstonecraft's Vindication combined natural rights arguments with utilitarian claims concerning the social benefits of sexual equality. She argued that women should be accorded civil and even political rights. She tried to show men that women's liberation from the Rousseauian ideal would actually benefit men. Thus, she wrote, "Make women rational creatures and free citizens, and they will quickly become good wives and mothers. If they fail," she argued, "that social decay should follow." Mary Wollstonecraft looked forward to the time when all women are active citizens, equally intent to manage her family, educate her children, and assist her neighbours. This, she argued, required a revolution in female manners. Mary Wollstonecraft is a pioneer in this area. Her assertion that women were an oppressed group should be seen as relatively new. Neither Rousseau nor Locke had recognised this fact. She viewed 18th century womanhood as an artificial construct crafted by male culture. And she despised the reduction of women to alluring objects and insignificant objects of desire. A third theme of Mary Wollstonecraft's work was that a revolution in female manners would help to transform the political and moral world for all, and not only for women. It called for the political representation of all citizens, recognising the fact that the majority of the British population, both male and female, enjoyed no political rights. This concentration on female manners was part of a more general debate taking place around the time of the French Revolution. Often, her vindication is portrayed as encouraging a female backlash led by conservative educators like Hannah Moore. However, Mary Wollstonecraft and Hannah Moore tend to agree on all the great points of female education. Domesticity, in both of their views, is seen as proffering women an opportunity for an active role and is defined in terms of social responsibility. At the heart of the work of both writers is the pattern of female heroism. Mary Wollstonecraft calls on middle-class women to eschew the static role and turn to nature, virtue and reason to become more observant daughters, more affectionate sisters, more faithful wives, more reasonable mothers, in a word, better citizens. Her manifesto remains middle-class motherhood in a radical framework of economic independence, legal equality, and freer access to jobs and professions. Hannah Moore, like Mary Wollstonecraft, also puts her faith in women of middle rank. She attests to women's potency to undermine or to save their country. Women bear special civil and social responsibilities. Both Moore and Wollstonecraft then appeal to female example so that women, by labouring to reform themselves, will reform the world. Women were now the reformers of public manners rather than the refiners. The focus on manners and who should be incorporated into the state as citizens also had implications for the role of men. It was argued that only virtuous and free individuals should be entrusted with political responsibility. All of these qualities were related to manliness in some form, and thus gender roles were central to the ways in which political life was defined. In contrast to earlier models of civility, the polite gentleman came from the middling sort, not the aristocracy. Politeness and commerce went hand in hand. By the end of the 18th century, then, it is argued that men and women were being pushed further apart into separate spheres of the public and private. To conclude, then, it's been argued that by 1832, women had lost their freedom to operate in public and political spheres. The 1832 Reform Act restricted the vote to men, for the first time. James Vernon has asserted that for women, but also for many men, the 1832 Reform Act represented a retreat, one which had given them less of a chance to be included within the official political nation than the unreformed electoral system. However, historians such as Linda Colley have argued that the vehemence of the literature surrounding the place of women in public illustrates the fact that the boundaries supposedly separating men and women were in fact unstable and becoming more so. What changed were the strategies used by women in the lower classes to participate in the public sphere. Their attention turned to new sites of political action within the home, family and community, as this is where they were able to exercise political power. Looking at the history of masculinity in Georgian Britain, there's also been a tendency to trace a move from a rough and ready 17th century manhood to a polite and civil 18th century masculinity. But Karen Harvey has recently argued that this progression may also be too simplistic. She argues instead that there are signs of a cyclical pattern. The later 18th century seems to have brought a revival of older modes of manhood, suggesting that the dominance of politeness was relatively short-lived, sandwiched between early modern and 19th century ideals that had much in common.